ambulance or a police car. Which is a...
Ah, the sounds of London. On a cold, wet Tuesday morning, strolling through Streatham. So, yeah, here we are in London.
Yeah. This is now the second edition of Shoot a Fat, live and direct from London. It's not live, it's a podcast, so it can't be. But anyway, you get the gist. We are here in London for a couple of days, and it's a very exciting month for many, many people who we'll be chatting to and have chatted to in the month on this podcast. And we wanted to really take the opportunity to walk on the right road, that's not it, and take the opportunity to interview someone who we've known for years and years and years, isn't that right?
Yes, absolutely. So Anna Haw, who we interviewed actually on our blog 3 or 4 years ago,
yes.
Is a bundle of energy, an amazingly talented chef, and we have crossed our paths on several occasions over the years, but so excited to have a proper catch up as she embarks on a huge step.
After becoming a name in the industry following 10 years in the kitchens of the Gordon Ramsay Group and more recently as head chef of Soho's iconic Bob Bob Ricard, talent native Anna Haw is embarking on her first entirely solo venture in London's trendy Chelsea.
The restaurant is called Myrtle, named after one of Anna's food heroes, the late great Myrtle Allen, founder of Ballymaloe Cookery School. However, Mrs. Allen isn't quite the only Myrtle in Anna's life.
The world. Myrtle. Oh, Myrtle.
She's so afraid, like she's petrified. She won't even look at you.
What breed is she?
She's a cross. She's a pug zoo. A half shih tzu, half pug.
Oh my God.
And she desperately needs a haircut. She's like a proper hippie at the minute.
Oh.
Myrtle.
She'll come down eventually.
In time. Just for...
I'll offer you a glass of wine or a gin and tonic.
Oh. Ooh.
Yeah?
Ooh.
Well, okay, so I've got some Irish gin.
Oh my God.
Some Irish gin. Or you can have a glass of Prosecco.
Oh, G&T will be fine, yeah. Been known, yeah. Thank you.
I don't know what this is going to be like. I'm sorry.
Which one is it?
This is a cinnamon.
Oh,
I've never tried it.
Fabulous one.
I've never tried it.
It's really, really good.
So I usually do, I'm not good at cocktails or anything like that.
Right.
But I usually do like a kind of rhubarb gin and tonic.
Right.
But because I had this is really citrusy, so... As a kind of gin goes, it's really citrusy. It has all the usual botanical coriander and juniper berry in it, obviously. But it's the most citrusy. It's the one you could sip this on rocks more than really any gin.
Yeah.
So that's why I thought, change this up.
No, that is beautiful.
It is.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
It's weird because we're not driving. Normally when we do these, we're driving.
Sorry,
and often it's that thing of, do you want a glass of wine? Do you want it for dinner? It's like, I can't, I'm driving. And it's,
I won't, but...
Well, actually, no, I tell a lie. It's like, no, he can't, he's driving. but I can.
And it's like, I'll have two.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oi, oi, oi.
Hello, stinky butt.
Hello, beautiful.
Oh, she's so cute.
Brilliant, though, I love her. Oh, I have no kids, so she's my furry baby. You're not recording that, are you?
No.
This is us as well, don't worry.
Two are obsessed with the dogs in all forms, all shapes, all sizes, obsessed. So it's in our future as well at some point.
Yeah.
But, such a brilliant. I tell you, I would love to get another dog for her because she's so playful.
Exactly,
I would get a rescue dog as opposed to a puppy.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, they're hard work.
Yeah.
And you can't leave them for any length of time.
No.
So I take her everywhere with me and I'm doing meetings for the restaurant and she's just there. She sits under the table and... You know, I bring a few little treats. Yeah, I bring some carrots. She loves carrots. Oh. She loves anything. She'll eat anything. She'll eat your shoe if you take it off.
So uh-oh. She's... Our soaking... Oh, yeah, but it's wet, so probably not nice.
You're dragging it before she eats it.
Yeah. Oh, a good
And you're like, what
morning.
Has she got?
I'm just trying to remember if I took the Teresa out of the bag. I did.
You did.
Yes, okay.
The smell of it is probably lingering around the bag at the minute.
So we basically pay our friend who we stay with in London with good bean treats, so... Because he loves it, so I'm basically like, can I stay? Look what I've got.
It's also because it is the best in the entire world. If you're speaking about Irish stuff, if you're speaking about chorizo in any form, it is the best.
Yeah, absolutely. I think everybody knows that now. It's not a secret anymore. Yeah. It's really a delicious salami.
And speaking of Irish products.
What do I like about Irish products? Yes. I love lots about Irish products. So in the restaurant, I wouldn't be very knowledgeable about certain aspects, so it's like a journey. Yeah. The bar will only have Irish poutines and Irish gins. So we would just obviously, instead of using vodka, we would use poutine because it is very similar. Mm. The only thing is there isn't really an appellation about it, and I don't know if that will eventually happen where they'll bring in stricter rules with, you know, what it needs to be made with, because it still can be made with potato or grain or corn or whatever. But, it, you know, most whiskies have a base of poutine, and I think that's where a lot of those new whiskey houses are coming from when they're bringing in those new gins and poutines. So, yeah, the restaurant will have a nice small selection of poutines, gins, and then bigger selection of whiskies. It won't be like a cocktail type restaurant, but we will have obviously cocktails available. So that's kind of the beginning of from when you first start, there'll be like an Irish influence there, but it is a modern European restaurant with an Irish influence. I think that's really important because it's so tempting for me just to say it's an Irish restaurant because that's a dream. But the food that I'm trained in is modern European. Mm. So it has to be like a healthy kind of, you know, development that turns into what I want it to be. So there will be Irish dishes on the menu. There'll be loads of Irish produce, but there still will be raviolis and, tortellinis and risotto and all sorts of things like that, which obviously are not Irish, but they're still delicious and they can still be made with, you know, Irish produce. And I think that's a big thing to make that clear. The signature dish will be a stuffed boxy dumpling. Oh.
Oh, it's sold.
Homeland is like, oh
Bigara.
Every Irish person in London is like, oh, boxy.
It is
rare over here though.
It's rare, and it's only known in kind of when you start to go more northern side of Ireland as well. It's better known, and there's three types of boxty. There's like a kind of crepe pancake boxty, there's like a potato farrel fried in a pan bread boxty, and then there's the dumpling one. So it's the dumpling one I'm currently focusing on. And it has braised beef in the center, so essentially it's like a similar to like a stuffed gnocchi, but there's a bit of raw potato as well as mashed potato in boxty. And then the beef comes from the Burren. So I have a butcher in Dublin called MK Meats. He's amazing, Mick Birmingham. He's going to source the cows or cow at a time from the Burren. I have to buy a whole cow at a time. He has an abattoir, so he'll slaughter it and he will send a quarter of a cow per week to me.
Wow.
Because you cannot buy Burren beef by cuts because there are only a limited amount of cows. You kind of have to buy the whole cow. Because when you think about it, if you want to do a rump steak, I mean, there's only so many rump steaks you'll get out of one cow. So it's very hard for I think, the butchers to break it down. Because I have tried in the past a lot to try to get any type of Burren beef. And all I could find was that it was that restaurants were, I think, coming together and buying it and then sharing the kind of animal. Yeah. So the signature dish is braised beef. So obviously most of the cow was braised beef. You've got two fillets, you've got two sirloins, and you got rump, and then the rest is braise, you know. Or actually, no, I've got anglette and bavettes. I've got a few little tricks up my sleeve up there. But yeah, the plan is that the signature dish will be this braised. And the reason why this beef is so special, oh my God, do you know about Burren beef?
No. A little bit.
I know nothing.
Yes.
You know. Tell me what you know.
It's from the Burren.
It's from...
I was there.
County Clare.
Rocky.
Yeah, these are very important facts. So basically, Origin Green, which was started up by Bord Bia, did something really spectacular. As the farmer kept saying, they brought in the scientists. And they brought in the scientists, and what they did is that they actually looked at the history of the land, and they figured out historically how we originally... farmed or raised our cattle was this way, where you have the Burren rock, which warms up all during the summer. So you don't feed them on the rock during the summer. You feed them on the grass just beside the rock, which is a bit of a stone's throw away, a bit of a walk. And by them feeding there in the summer, they just eat lovely gorgeous green luscious grass, and then in the winter they go onto the burn rock, which has gathered all of the amazing heat that comes from the Irish sun during the summer.
All of that. A whole afternoon of it.
But because it, for, you know, whatever, our three hottest months, what it means is that during late autumn and all through winter, it's a warmer place for the cattle to live. So this is the time before we even had houses. So everybody was living like wild. You probably died when you were 18.
Yeah.
But yeah, and it, if they fed, which is so, this is what really blows my mind. If they actually did it the other way around, well, first of all, the cattle would die from cold or whatever. But for every square foot, there's like something, you know, 34 fauna and flowers that grow. So if they fed them during the summer, they would eat all the budding flowers, and it would actually kill all of these new, you know, the what comes secondly afterwards. So it wouldn't be there the next year. How did they know this? They couldn't read and write. They couldn't even bleed and make a house.
It's all through instinct, I guess.
It's just incredible. Yeah. Or maybe they damaged a certain part of another area. I don't know. But yeah, so the scientists came in and figured that out.
Great.
Gathered up the farmers together and said, listen, are you interested in trying to change? Because they'd all gone back to the, you know, the modern way of farming. Yeah. And they did. And it was genuinely one of the most inspiring days of my life. And I said, this has got to come with me back to London. Yeah. Like, nobody has heard of this. And they should, because people are wagyu this, wagyu that. Mm. Hello, excuse me. Burr, you know where you can stick your wagyu right now? Because this is, you know, what the animal is eating is really special. And, you know, you can't lose sight of that. If you are feeding a cow hay, which obviously lots of cows have to eat during the winter months when they're indoors, away from the natural vitamin D or whatever we get from the sun, to the idea that we keep them out all year round and they're eating nutritious feed all year round. Mm. I know they do supplement it with something else. They call it a nut. And it's some sort of thing that the scientist has come up with. Which comes from the same nutrition that they would gather on the land just to make sure that they've got absolutely enough feed. But it's really special. So that's a signature on the dish. So where is possible, I will have obviously prime cuts. Yeah. But they will be quite expensive. The whole thing is expensive. So by me making the signature dish being braised beef and celebrating not just a fillet or a sirloin, I'm hoping that I'll be able to kind of still be, you know, a reasonably priced restaurant. But if you want a ribeye or if you want a sirloin, going to be top end. Well, considering, you know, only a couple of tables can get it per month.
Yeah, exactly. You have to wait on that DHL delivery to come along with the quarter of a cow.
How very dare you. How long have you held on to the idea of this place?
So the site or the concept?
The concept.
So I've lots of sad stories of where I tried to do it a good few years ago. And there's this quote I see everywhere, and I'm not mad about Instagram quotes, but it says, what's the quote? If you're tired, take a rest, don't give up. Mm-hmm. So when you're trying to open a restaurant and you're a chef and you don't have a backer and you're choosing not to have a backer, because you will get backers, but you know, you sell your soul sometimes when you have a backer. Sometimes things just don't go your way and you're trying to get a site and you get very close and then it would fall down and you go back again. And I'd been doing it for quite a while and we were supposed to sign on a lease, and then the landlord just pulled me aside and said, this must be nearly 8 years ago. And he goes, sorry, no, I'm going to keep it now. And I was like, and I'd already started to spend money on it, on lots of different things. Mm. And
how convenient.
So I remember going home that day and getting into bed. I don't even think I took my clothes off. And I just cried because I've been working really hard for 2 years to get to that stage. And I thought I was about to open this gorgeous little small. And this was actually going to be an Irish restaurant because it was like 20 seats. I would be the only chef. It was going to make it easier. The menu would be tiny. And then, I don't think I got out of bed for at least 24 hours. And then I just said, I turned around to my partner at the time and I just said, I'm going to go back and get a job. I can't do this anymore. And he was like, brilliant, off you go, because I'm sick of this. I think I've always looked back on that and just went, it was a mistake, but I was tired. I was really, really tired, and also afraid of all of the obstacles that you have to jump through. And then a couple of years ago, I just decided I'm going to do this again. I can't help it. It's like an addiction.
Yes.
And my boyfriend kept saying to me, so, you know, is there like a date that you might like just, you know, he's English. He's not from D4. Is there like a date?
So it's not Russell Carroll Kelly then. No. Okay. Just making sure.
But he's like, is there a date that you would just say, I've tried and I'm not going to do it. And I literally was flipping him the bird every day.
Yeah.
Ask me that question again. Yeah. I'm not taking this. And I found this site in the summertime, and we open in May. So it's not for the faint-hearted opening a restaurant, especially when you don't have backers or you don't have people who could, you know, drive decisions in a way that would make it faster. So it's been slower because of fear. I think a big part is like, oh God, what chairs should I buy? Oh my God, who should I pick? So that does delay things. But then also it's lack of experience and, you know, taking a site that has no electricity and no central heating and the floors are all in bits and, you know, that kind of stuff. But I've got a beautiful, gorgeous, tiny little nugget in Chelsea. Mm. And that doesn't come for free. So, yes, it has needed work. And I think the landlord seems like a really good kind of family that own it. But I think that, yeah, I, you know, had to wait a while to get the lease and stuff all kind of ironed out.
Wow. And with the restaurant, we were actually only discussing before we hit record on this, we're just talking about ourselves and how life is going, and we were describing the thing that, you know, oh, as bloggers, we're also writers, accountants, agents, graphic designers, website development, all this type of stuff, photographer, food stylist, the list goes on.
Yes.
And with this restaurant, you're not just chef.
No, I'm everything.
You're absolutely everything.
Everything. Like, I get asked questions sometimes. Oh, what size do you want your skirting? What? Do you think I care what size my skirting is? Make the decision yourself. And they're like, well, you can have this at such and such millimeter and this. And I'm like, oh. I'm like, Lee, please. And then I'll have Joe, the guy who's doing the electrics and the lighting. He's like, well, you know, you really can't have a green light in here or a red light. And I was like, I don't want green or red lights. No, I mean like a light that has a green or a blue hue of it. And I'm like, oh my God. I don't care. Like, I really, but I have to care.
Yeah, of course.
And then, you know, all everything, like, you know, how many forks do you want? Oh my God, I have to know that. I have to know these answers.
And it's something that when you're behind the pass, you've never had to think about before.
No, you're like, I'm running out of forks. Boop, 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 boop. Hi, can I have more forks? to the
forks
big bosses.
For you, yeah.
To
the, amazing.
But where now it's like, oh, hang on a second. They £3.50 each per fork. Share the forks at the table. You can't have a fork each.
Oh my God.
Wow.
Yeah.
It must be intense then.
Yeah, trying to keep the budget is because it's a limited budget, but every so often you see something, you're like, oh, I quite like that. That looks quite pretty. I was like, I planned I just would have a wood bar top, but now it's green and it's sparkly. So then you're like, what can I do to reduce it? And then I just keep trying to tweak it and tweak it so that I can create the nicest possible little thing.
Maybe.
So, yeah. So, but it will be a reflection of what it is. So, you know, you might have to stand because there's no chairs. You know, let's be real, guys, okay? I've run out of money. I bought the bloody granite.
It's a standing dining experience, okay? As long as you can...
Concept.
Yeah, as long...
really pack in the numbers.
Like, come on, Anna. This is London at the end of the day. You can get away with it.
Concept.
Yeah. They love all this type of stuff. Yeah. If you could just call it a concept, an experience, a bespoke space where you can eat and possibly drink... Because we haven't built the bar yet.
It's actually healthier if you stand and eat and calories. The calories and all that. Of course. I mean, instant sell.
Yeah. God, London.
You're now my PR team.
Deal.
But property in London, is it as crazy as it is in Ireland? It's absolutely extortionate.
It's bonkers. One of the sites, one of the last sites that I looked at was in the same area. And it started off, and it's roughly the same size, a bit smaller. Kitchen was really, really tiny. But the rent was 75K per year, which is a lot for a 40-seater restaurant. This is a lot of money. You got to really fill that restaurant up. And each time I was going back to the landlord, I'd really jump through hoops because I'm a gamble. I haven't opened my own business before. I've only opened it for other people. Mm. Landlords don't care about your CV. They're like, can you show us proof that you will succeed? And I'm like, no, I can show you my GPs from when I worked for somebody else. And they're like, no. So you really have to jump through hoops trying to sell it to them. Anyway, went through it. Everything was great. We were going ahead. And then they started to up it. And they were like, oh, can you do 100 grand? And I'm like, no. I was like, do you want to see my business plan? I'll break it down. Like, no, this makes no sense. If you want me to last, you know, I think it was an 18-year lease. If you want me to last 18 years, I can't pay that kind of thing. They're like grand. And eventually got to the stage where it was going to be 150 grand. They were going to take a percentage. So each time that I made a bit more money, they would take a bit more rent, a bit more. So they were going to be in my books. And I had to walk away from that. And that was a really dark day because it was a beautiful location. It was amazing. It was near Bibendum. It was really, really an amazing location. But I had to just walk away and go, no, it just the maths just don't work. And I remember the day before I said no, I called up Adam Byatt and I said, hi, Adam, I know you're like super famous and stuff. Can I get your advice? Because you're so close. You know, your nose is so close to what you're doing. And it's you know it's wrong, but you're like, it's okay, it's okay. And they're so nice. They're so nice to me. They wouldn't rip me off. And, you know, and he was like, Anna, he's like, every pound you make, it'll just, you'll lose it. Mm. And he goes, you'll be broken. By the end of it, you'll just be almost feeling like you're working for nothing. Mm. And I was like, there's no one I wanted to hear. No. But it was what I needed to hear. Mm. And I walked away and I was like, then I got shown sights here in Streatham Hill and I was like, what? There I was in Chelsea in my ball gowns and now I'm in Streatham Hill dodging crack addicts and people drinking White Lightning. So
it's not the look you were going for, no.
And it was so exciting.
It's a different concept.
Yeah. So, and I love Streatham Hill. I love living here, but it's a while before I think they're ready for what I want to do. Mm. And I was a couple of weeks and then just this little gem was sent into my emails and nobody else had seen it. And I was like, I want it. I don't need to view it. Yeah. It's it. This is it. This is it. And I went to see it and that's it. No central heating. Floors are in bits. No electricity. No, everything's all over the place. And I'm like, yes, perfect. Yeah. What could go wrong?
I love a challenge.
I love it. So that's how I, you know, whipped up 1A Langton Street.
Wow.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
How long are you over here since?
Donkey's years. I got asked a question recently, am I Irish-English or English-Irish? You know, when people live here for a long time. I was like, oh my God.
Have I converted? Am I over the threshold?
I'm Irish-Irish. I'm not just Irish-Irish, I'm Dublin-Dublin. Mum and dad are both Dublin. I'm living here, I don't know. I say, if you look at any interviews that I've done over the past few years, sometimes I say 13, 15, 16, 18. I've no idea. It's definitely over 15 years.
Okay.
But like, I love London and I also love an Englishman. So, you know, I feel kind of connected to their culture a little bit. But you can't take the Ireland out of me. Like, you can't. I mean, the idea when I first said I wanted to do like an Irish restaurant or an Irish influenced restaurant, people were like,
Irish?
Yeah, they were like, what's the Irish food? And I'm like, shut up. My mother came from Dublin Mountains. All my mother knew was Irish food.
Yeah.
There was no television for, they didn't have a television in their house until like my granny, I think, passed away. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Maybe not that late. That was pretty bad. But you know, they there was no internet. There was no, where would granny get her recipes but from her own mother? So I was like, what do you think Irish people have been eating for years?
Exactly.
So, we have a cuisine, but it's not glamorous. And I think it's up to chefs nowadays to take those old recipes and, you know.
So that leads us nicely on, because throughout our endeavours on this podcast, we have constantly been asking about what is Irish food to people? Because it is, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg, I suppose, in a lot of cases in Irish cuisine and Irish culture at the moment. But you're the first person that we've interviewed who's on the outside of it. So overlooking the island as opposed to sitting on the island going, God, what do we eat? And racking your brains. So I think, put the question to you as we do with everyone, what is Irish food?
So I believe Irish food is, if you go to an area and you've got lamb being farmed in that area and you look at the other vegetables that grow in that area, you would imagine that what would a person do with that animal? So obviously we've got recipes that we know of, that we've heard of in the past, like, you know, an Irish stew. But depending on where you are eating your Irish stew, that could be made with beef or that could be made with lamb. It's not all lamb. And I think that's really important that people understand that, like, there's Dublin food and there's like Northern Ireland food, and they'd a couple of more books than us. So there's a bit more documentation about Northern Irish cuisine. You know, they had more desserts than we had our tea bracks and our apple tarts and things like that. But really what you look at is you have to use a little bit of imagination. So I got to take what my mother cooked for us, which was a lot of meat and two veg. And then I got to introduce the training that I received in kitchens and refine that. So you're using the ingredients that grow off the land beside the animal you know, would possibly have eaten it, or at least just hung around that area and the farmers wouldn't have let it. But we have a strong kind of, you know, associating with vegetables that can handle the cold. Yeah, so obviously anything to do with a cabbage is definitely something that we can do. The most beautiful, amazing things. Like, one of the dishes I want to do is like a take on bacon and cabbage, but not like separate, like carved bacon and shredded cabbage. The idea of it being like choux farci, which is the French dish, which is all of the dishes combined and cooked together. So obviously, if you cook bacon and cabbage properly, you boil your bacon or your ham, and then you cook your cabbage afterwards for at least 4 hours.
At least.
Oh God.
But there is something really magical of actually the meat and the vegetable being genuinely cooked together, not just the stock. There's like a chemical reaction. Like, it's like when you make apple crumble. Yeah. And you make your crumble and you make your apple puree. And then you reheat it in the oven and on a high heat, you've got a nice apple crumble. But if you do your apple crumble like from raw apple and your raw crumble, there is a chemical reaction where all of those flavors just give each other kisses.
Yeah.
And they create like a new flavor. And I think that's really important with cooking, because when I was first trained, everything was cooked individually in separate little pots. And I don't think that that actually creates the chemistry and the magic of cooking. So to go back to what I think Irish food is, I think it's the ingredients that are related to each other on the land. And a lot of it is braised. It isn't all about prime cuts, because we do have a history of when we had a gang of people who lived on our land and they took all the good stuff and they left us with the less good stuff.
I believe no one's ever talked about this before. Who are they?
Yeah, so they look like us.
They sound kind of like us.
But I think a big part of it is that an awful lot of the luxury items were taken from us. And so that's why an awful lot of our repertoire is, you know, broths, big broths and stews and you know, boiled potatoes. And weirdly, what I'm always amazed, remember when I was a kid, the boiled potatoes with no skins on was like a big thing. We're so fancy. We have no skin. You know, my dad was obsessed with potato skin. And it was like the idea that no skin was seen as, aren't we fancy? Throwing away the skins. Because obviously we used to, skins used to be actually our potatoes.
Yeah.
We didn't eat potatoes because those people got the potato.
Those who shall not be named got the potato.
But like, I say stuff like this to my boyfriend, because obviously he was the one eating the potato back in the day. He's like, and obviously they're not taught it in school, so he actually finds hard to laugh at it. He's like, what do you mean? I was like, you nicked everything from us.
Starving. Anything?
No, oh, then it goes dark. Yeah. It's like, yeah.
Please say you've brought him to the memorial on the keys.
No, I haven't. I haven't. And I was meant to bring him to Dublin. I was home in Dublin there recently. And instead, I decided to go with my two best girlfriends, who both are from Dublin. Let's have a tour around Dublin. And we did, like, went to the, you know, by Christchurch to the, what's it called? Dublinia?
Yes.
And we went to St. Patrick's Cathedral, and we went to Jemison, and we went to all these different places to see a bit of Dublin. I thought, you know, he doesn't need to see that.
Yeah.
Three Dublin girls, we need to do that.
Wild.
Yeah.
Help ground you.
But I actually won a competition. It was like a lucky dip thing with a business card. And I was like a tourist for Ireland thing that I won over here. So it was very lucky. So I got to stay in the Merrion and we had afternoon tea. And it was just, honestly, I'm so overflowing with pride for Ireland. Mm. But like when you do something like that, it's so special. But go to the Burren. Oh my God.
Yeah. We were just there.
Where
were you?
Yeah.
So we took our first trip there a week ago. And it was only for 24 hours or so.
Yeah.
But the driving through it. And the scenery, and
it's amazing.
And there are so many cows.
Oh my God.
And fields of cows. So it's an amazing area of Ireland. Amazing.
And also, there's loads of small artisan producers in the Burren and around, stretching further than the Burren. And this is like a secret that people don't know about. So things like, there's like this kind of, I guess you could describe it as like a co-op delivery system that I'm trying to be part of to get them over here. And it's, some stuff is from the Burren and some stuff is from Dublin and from everywhere. And the idea is that I'm trying to get reasonable sized amounts of produce over regularly to London. And it's called, I think it's called Hussey Foods is the guy who's organizing it. So it's Bala McKenney and McNally Farms and all of these people who are really doing like amazing stuff. So it's like, I've been buying royal potatoes or violet potatoes. They've got a million names. Truffle potatoes, you know, they've got a million names. The same deep purple potato. I've been buying them for the last 16 years, whatever that I've been in London, from only France.
Yeah.
Mm. Only France. And the idea that sometimes they're not deeply purple, sometimes they're white, and then they go brown really easy. Mm. Where these potatoes that they are producing are incredible. And not just their specialist potatoes, they also do really good bags of chipping potatoes, yeah, and potatoes that have got loads of flavour in them. Mm. And a lot of women are doing, which is surprisingly, doing these small artisan projects, because the farm is massive and they obviously make a big load of money out of the bigger stuff that the old husband is doing.
Oh, yeah.
But that the women are focusing on doing really special art. It's a bit like, you know, we have a lot of famous cheesemongers that are women.
Mm.
And Myrtle Allen was one of the first people who would go down to, because of where they were in Cork, there's loads of cheesemongers in Cork. Mm. And she went down to them and said, listen, I know you're exporting all of your cheese to, like, basically it was all to America and some over here to England, and then there was some over to France, real specialist stuff. And she goes, listen, will you sell me, you know, a certain amount per week, and I will only do an Irish cheese board. This seems like, yeah, big deal. Loads of great Irish cheese, right? We're not even, we're not really proud of our cheese. We're kind of like, yeah, fine, we know we do good cheese. But it's like, look at the French, the way they bang on about their cheese.
Yeah.
Our cheese is as good as their
Absolutely.
Cheese. But she was the first person who was like, yeah, we're as good, let's serve it. And I think that's a big thing. It was like, it's still, it's not really known. Like, I've got a toasted sandwich for you guys when you're ready. And it's Cosh na Tíre. So it's like a really nice cheese, which is like in between like a cheddar and a Parmesan. It's got a nice personality to it, but it's nutty and it's kind of sweet. So it's like when you look at Coulée, which is a beautiful cheese, but it's a bit more like punchy. Yeah. So like when I'll put a little bit of Coulée in my box tea because it's really punchy. Where for a cheese sandwich, you want more cheese. So I think the Cosh na Tíre is a really good cheese in there as well. And there's just stuff like this that it's not in our fridges. Like we have Kerrygold and we've got Barry's, but you know, they're brilliant, but there's also more that we could, you know, have that's Irish.
I guess throughout this is our third season of this now, and across all of our interviews, we kind of try to establish, is Irish cuisine an emerging cuisine globally, or is it just in Ireland?
I think that's a really good question. So we have a bit of a backlash from Irish people because we're like, no, all the good stuff is like in France or in Italy. And I think that's just a misconception because they're like, well, I'm Irish and I don't really know anything about really good Irish cookery. Not me in particular, but a lot of people. So they kind of find it, maybe they have to be convinced. So I think it's a slow burner, but I think once it really picks up momentum, there's no reason why it shouldn't. There's so many talented Irish chefs that have traveled all over the world. And the whole point of the reason why the French cuisine was so good or the Italian cuisine was so good is because there were chefs that were associated with the leaders of the world. They had so much money. They had every single engineer to create any type of equipment that they needed, any space that they needed. All the chefs died, like, seriously, when they were so young, though, because they were all had like black lung or something from the coals that ran the ovens. But they had worth it. But they had, like, when you think about how the hell, Gates, did they create ice cream before an ice cream machine, please, or anything, like even a meringue, who just said, I'm just going to whisk this by hand for ages and gently add a little bit of sugar and then I'm going to bake it at a really low heat. Like, who did this? But you know, the point why these kind of countries are famous for cuisine is because they had loads of money behind them and knowledge. So the whole idea of what can happen with Irish cuisine is that we just take our produce and basic recipes that were Irish and we introduce them to knowledge of technique. And there's no reason why our cuisine should be held back, because it's about a personality. Cuisine is a personality, and Ireland has buckets of personality. So if you've got Irish chefs creating Irish food, you're going to have a new cuisine. It's like if you go to a Indian restaurant and you find out that the person cooking the Indian food is from, let's just say, Kilkenny, and they've never been to India, and they just really love Indian food, they'll do their best to follow those recipes, but they mightn't necessarily capture Indian cuisine because they never actually lived around the area where the spices grew, or the idea of what their mother prepared in the really rustic, poor way. What will make Irish cuisine are the Irish chefs, or maybe some foreign people who live in Ireland and have absorbed the culture. It's not just that. But yeah, I think that's really what will be the making of our cuisine. Yeah. But it'll take a while. It's, you know, we're new, we're exciting, fresh.
We're only 100-odd years old.
because of the aforementioned.
And on the topic of training and chefs, is it important to be classically trained, or is it an option for anyone who's interested to just head out into a kitchen and earn a crust?
I think that's a really kind of fun question because my background was very strict, really. You know, I was very lucky that I started off in a great kitchen, Lekkervan, and I continued on that vein. So I have a pet hate where people are like, I'm a self-taught chef. I'm like, where did you work? Oh, I worked here, here, and here. I'm like, well, you're not self-taught. Because just because you watch something and people didn't show you, doesn't mean you weren't taught. To learn, you come from all different things. It can be reading a book, but it also can be just watching hands. That's not really self-teaching. Self-teaching is being locked in a room where nobody else is there and you start creating stuff. There you taught yourself. Yeah. But I do believe the idea that when you have no background, no experience, go to a kitchen, cook for a few years, you're a chef. Doesn't matter about where you've worked or what you've done or where you've learned in college, you're still a chef because you've learned a cuisine from that kitchen where you worked. So it's all relative to where you work. So if you go and you work in an Italian restaurant, well, then you are Italian trained. And like my background is modern European, particularly with French technique. And that was because I searched out kitchens that had that style. That's what I wanted to understand. So when I left college, I mean, I didn't know my arse from my elbow. Like, I'll be honest with you. I remember I left college and I didn't know what concass is. So I'm assuming that some of the people who are listening don't know what concass is. It's where you like boil a tomato where you've crossed it at the top and at the bottom for seconds so that you can peel the skin off, cut it down into quarters, remove the seeds and put it into perfectly diced tomato pieces that are roughly the size of your index fingernail. I left college and I'd heard everybody go, I'm sick of doing concass. Concass this guy. And I was like, I really wonder what this concass thing is. I was like genuinely like, oh, I feel like it sounds like a stew. It sounds fancy, concass. They're all sick of making it. Why haven't I made it? Because there was four different classes. And I went into my professional job, which was at Lekkervan, without knowing what concass was. And I was like, they're going to find out. Everybody knows concass. I don't. And then once I made concass, I was like, oh, made it, you know? Fooled them. They didn't know. They hired me without me being able to do it. And the truth is, all I knew was theory, watery theory when I arrived in my job. I may as well have not gone to college. I'd have still become the same chef I am today. You know, you make it through your own kind of motivation and your own kind of drive. But I would definitely encourage people, if you want a job, knock on a door. Knock on a door of a kitchen where you ate a meal and you were like, I want to be able to cook that food. That's the only way I've ever found a job. And I genuinely mean it. Like, I flew over to London to eat in pied-à-terre when I was working in Lekkervan. And I remember just being like, couldn't afford petit fours. Couldn't afford petit fours, but we're like, oh my God, petit fours. They like tempered chocolate and stuff. They've got like mini little things. But it was like, no, I've got no money. I can't afford the whatever it was, £4 for the coffee. Which is like, when you think about it, that's how poor I was. Like, I can't imagine what rig out I had. I think I got it off my sister as a loan. But I went back to Dublin, you know, and I worked for another bit. But by the time I moved to London, I was like, straight up there. That's the kitchen I wanted to work in. Yeah. I wanted to learn what the vinaigrette that was on the frisée salad that went with the foie gras and duck terrine that I tasted. I wanted to know how a vinaigrette could taste like that. I make that vinaigrette today, you know? And that's every job that I've worked in. I've eaten in the restaurant and I was like, I want to learn that and I'm really not very good. So you have to be good to teach me. So so I've made every mistake in the book and that's how I eventually learned the trade. But yeah, knock on that door, go to that restaurant, get that job.
Home economics, how important is it? And I'm trying to put this
right. Well, you didn't do home ec, did you?
You did it in TY. There's a real argument and there's a conversation about its importance, how it's taught, the curriculum, the skills and stuff. So on the subject of home economics, have you an opinion?
Yeah. I did home economics when I didn't know I'd be a chef. It was like, first of all, an interesting subject. What? Like a subject that's interesting? And that even the idea of practicing the cookery. Now, I think we did have a particularly good teacher that we did our cookery lessons with. and we learned how to make proper scrambled eggs, which I think is that's what your home economics should be, yeah. You know, not just making a goddamn pizza. You know, it's about like proper cookery where it's like, I just have eggs in the fridge. What do I do? Yeah. It's like, oh, I'm going to make a pizza. Let me get my yeast. Oh, I don't have that. Let me get my strong flour. I don't have that. Where's my olives? Mozzarella. You've none of that in your fridge, but you've always got eggs. I think home economics is so important. And bizarrely, it's associated with having ovaries and a vagina. Mm-hmm. You know, when you'd go to school, the boys would go do something techie. Yeah. And the girls are supposed to do home economics. And I just think that's so wrong because... it's a life skill.
Yeah.
To be able to feed yourself without giving yourself diabetes or a heart attack is really important. And some people have bad diets because they think cooking is too complicated. And it's not. And like, I'm a real honest chef, so I will have the guilty pleasures. I'll have my MSG coca noodles when I'm hungover and I've had a serious bender the night before. But then on my, especially Monday, when I have my fish day and I'm like, look at me, I'm going to be like size 6 because I'm going to live on this food all day long. But I'll have like, you know, the freshest ingredients and I'll just know how to grill a piece of fish nicely and blanch some nice vegetables and make a vinaigrette. And that's not complicated. I'll do that in 15 minutes, not Jamie Oliver style, like real style, you know? And my boyfriend, I really introduced him to all of that kind of cookery. So sometimes we have heart attack food, you know, that takes me days to make. And other times I'll just throw together like a really fresh, delicious veg and protein and, you know, carbohydrate. Yeah. You know, it doesn't all have to be lettuce and, you know, frills and stuff. But yeah, I think home economics is vital. And the idea of knowing your vitamins, like where certain things come from and what type of vitamins you need regularly. This is home economics. Like you need your vitamin C every poxy day. You need your red meat because you've got B group vitamins in there that you can't almost get from anything else. You can, but it's hard. And the idea of understanding, have your red meat, brilliant. Like once a week, you animal. Don't be like trying to have it every day, you know? And the whole idea of educating people properly from a young age, kind of going, a burger's great, but actually a steak is better. If you're, I mean, I know price points should always come into it. People should be aware of, you know, not everybody can afford a steak. Well, with the way we have our meat in supermarkets, it's complicated because you go to France and a minute steak is as cheap as a burger. You know what I mean? So it's you know, it's kind of a cultural thing as well. But I think home economics is vital. It's, I mean, it's layers and layers of importance. And also home economics did more than just food. Like the name is home economics. So it was a bit more. It was about budgeting and it was about like, you know, using things up and being resourceful. And these are like some people... really struggle with those basic things.
And it's all on trend to be resourceful, sustainable and everything like that. So it would be very handy if we all had to do it.
Bottom of the fridge dinner.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, we're all there. Ooh, it's a bit soft. Yeah. Is it okay? Is it okay?
Oh, it's a bit blue. It's fine. Scrape it off.
Scrape it off.
So when you were a home ec student, what was your specialty? It wasn't braised beef boxty or anything.
No, but I was raised by an incredible woman. So actually, I was raised by an incredible woman and man. So mom was the cook. But dad is adventurous. Now, mom's brilliant. Like, she's such a naturally good cook. It's actually, like, when she follows some recipes, and the recipe is good. This is vital. There's so many crap recipes out there. When the recipe is good, mom follows the recipe, and I'll taste something, I'll go, without sounding arrogant, but I could have made that. Like, it's that good. You know, this woman doesn't appreciate salt. She thinks it's a little bit like sprinkling heroin on food. She doesn't agree with it. So she has salt in the house because I refuse to eat an egg without salt or cook for them. So they have salt, but they bring it out like this, you know. There you go. There's the heroin. We don't approve, but, you know. You're the youngest one, so we let you away with blue murder. But she also saw sugar. So if you put a spoon of sugar, you know, my sister's famously, when they're having an argument, took the sugar bowl, put a spoon of sugar, she doesn't like sugar in her tea, put it in the tea and stirred it like real slowly, like, what are you going to do about it, mom? But that's because my mom really became a housewife during the time when the government did a massive thing about fat, sugar, salt. It's all bad, which was, you know, we know in hindsight now, wasn't technically correct. It's all about moderation and the idea of animal fats are better than the homogenized muck and blah, 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 blah. But she's a brilliant cook. So she taught us all homemade stuff. So stocks or bone broths or whatever people call it nowadays, I came out of the womb with that boiling in the house. Do you know what I mean? She used to do awful things like homemade cereal, which tasted fine, but she put too much wheat germ on them, which was like getting an electric shock in your mouth.
Yeah.
But everything was homemade. She was mad about, like, homemade jams were made every year. Like, it was all homemade stuff. And I was just raised with that. So I was self-taught, you know?
Without salt.
No. But yeah, when I discovered salt, so Lekkervan taught me salt. I'm not joking. I remember making a pea puree with garlic and onion. And there was a sous chef called Ruth, amazing. The kitchen had loads of strong women in it. It was an incredible kitchen to start off in. Anyway, I put salt in, because they said put salt in. I was like, okay, you know, I'll put a little bit of the heroin in the food. But I was like, and then, and I tasted it. I was like, that's good, I like that. And she was like, more. I was like, more. Oh. I put it more, and I was like, it tastes better. And then she went, and then she goes, more. And I was like, and I almost was like, I think we need to have a chat. I think you have a problem. But she went more, and each time I tasted it, I was like, this is better and better. What is this magical ingredient? And then the idea of learning about the idea of different salts and how they have different flavors. Natural salts like sea salts are different than your manky table salt. Anyway, to go back to Wendy, who, you know, taught me how to cook but not season. She now seasons her food because the student became the teacher at a stage. But only a mild student. She's totally able. She doesn't need my help with anything. She's so brilliant. But she taught us, and I think that's a big thing about my signature dishes. Could have been anything. Sandwiches are legendary in our house. Legendary. My sister lives in Spain. She's lived in Spain for years, maybe the same time I've lived over here. And she woke up in the morning, Mom and Dad, up and at them. Around there. And Dad, she walks past the kitchen. Dad's like, "How are you, love? Do you want a sea bass sandwich?" And she's like, "For breakfast." Which just sounds insane, but he'd made her go to the fish market the day before and bought a sea bass the size of like a 9-year-old child, right? It was like a whale, right? And for like 4 adults, how much sea bass can you eat? They really can actually pack the fish away, but still they couldn't finish it. So breakfast, he woke up and he was like, "Do you know what I want?" Sea bass. But it sounds insane now, right? But it wasn't insane because kippers for breakfast. There's also smoked salmon for breakfast. So what's wrong with a sea bass sandwich? Yeah. It's just weird. But then they'd be like, "Ooh, what's that? Artichoke?" They were never afraid of anything. Artichoke and sea bass sandwich, a bit of spinach. And, you know, and then they'll have coleslaw or something weird on there. But still, you're like, great lube. That actually makes it all match. Yeah. So my mother, like when she makes a sandwich, you're like, "What are you doing over there?" "Nothing. Just making a sandwich." And you'd be like, "I saw her with an egg and blue cheese. And I'm pretty sure I saw chili. I don't know what she's doing." And then you eat it and you're like, "Oh my God, this is amazing." So but the sandwiches are famous since we were kids. They're like a really a meal that we just, I don't know. And it's all in us. So if you go to my brother's house or my sister's, if they make a sandwich, they're very, everybody's like, "Oh, put a bit of this on it." You're like, "I'm not sure if I want that." They're like, "You need this."
Trust me.
Yeah, there's lots of that. So yeah. Wow. Yeah, so.
Signature dish sandwich.
I love that. The simplicity of it all.
Yeah.
We always, whenever we make sandwiches, we always go, "We're doing a Nigel Slater. I'm going to start off with a sandwich."
He is a king of the sandwich as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
It's all about whatever sauce or, like, I love a homemade mayonnaise. For me, this is the killer sauce because it's like, you just start off with any ingredient you want. So it could be tarragon, it could be anchovy, it could be any, it could even be actually a bean of some sort. And you get in your acid or your spice or something else and then emulsify it with oil and you just have like an amazing lubricant that goes on your bread. And this is the key to a good sandwich is your layering.
Oh my God, that mayo. You shouldn't have said mayo to me.
Okay. So
oh my God.
Our new favorite thing.
Oh my God. So we got it in Galway the other day and it's a smoked onion mayo.
Amazing.
Oh.
I love it already. I can taste it already.
Yeah. You can. And it is as in your face as if you imagine smoked onion mayo. It is exactly the flavor you think of in your mind.
And that would make a sandwich. Chicken sandwich, smoked onion mayo. Oh. Done. You don't even have to add anything else.
No.
It's amazing.
Other than salt.
Oh, other than heroin, salt, sorry. Yeah. Malden heroin is especially, or alkaline heroin is fabulous these days. We're lucky we've Oriel heroin up the road from us, actually. Don't salt, sorry.
Can you imagine if someone just came in and heard that? They were like, "These guys are really into heroin."
Yeah. Oh, no, but there's also artisan producers of it all around the country. It's fantastic.
Ireland makes heroin, huh?
We don't have to import it anymore. It's great. It's, oh, I'm just, sorry, I'm just dreaming of all these random combinations. And I have been, I actually couldn't sleep the other night because when we get sent quite a lot of product. So every so often something comes in and I'm like, well, I just have to try it. And if we buy something new, I'm like, okay, we just have to try it because if I don't try it, I won't know what it will go with or anything.
Of course.
And it was about 11:30 at night. We're packing to come over to London. And I was like, oh, we haven't opened the mayo. Get a spoon. So I just had two spoons.
I
instructed you.
Yeah.
I was like, open it.
I was like, no, I'll wait. Open it. It's like, okay. Like,
open it.
And so two teaspoons of mayo and just ate them. And then I went into bed and I was just lying there. And I spent about 2 hours lying in bed thinking about mayo and what I could use it with.
I think you had more than one spoon, by the way. For the record, it was more than one.
Oh, someone's installed cameras in the kitchen.
but you can a good mayo, like a really good mayonnaise. So I'm not talking about your real generic, massively factory-produced mayonnaise that you get. But a really good mayonnaise is the equivalent of a delicious dip, like a Lovage mayonnaise. It's amazing.
Absolute heaven.
Yeah.
But even a simple aioli.
You can't beat it.
I know.
Heavy on garlic.
Roast potato and aioli. It's just so good.
Again, it's the old potato.
It's true.
It is.
We're addicted to potatoes.
Addicted to potatoes. Like, without a shadow of a doubt, it's one of my favourite things. When I have a roast dinner and I'm like, be good, Anna, now come on. You've really been eating for more than you should. Now come on, now behave yourself. And I'm like, fine. I'll have my roast dinner, I'll have no meat, and I'll have extra potato.
Yes.
Like I would, I'd sacrifice.
It all even that
which I shouldn't sacrifice my protein, but I would to have an extra roast potato. Yeah. Love it. And awesome. Yorkshire puddings, we're always doing them. Actually, I make him make them. He actually does a better job than me with the Yorkshires. I never had a Yorkshire pudding until I come over here. So I'm like, yeah, they're grand. But what, I'm going to sacrifice a potato for Yorkshire pudding? Please.
Absolutely not.
Please.
I will say, there is a difference if you compare an English roast and an Irish roast. Huge ocean there.
I think that was the worst thing about our breakup with London was Sundays, because we got into such a habit.
Roast.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We got into such a habit of a Sunday, because we lived in Peckham and we had so many great places around, and we love an Irish pub, but we love an Irish pub for drinking in.
Yes.
Eating, so often there are some great exceptions to that rule.
Oh God, this is like news to me, because I'm over here.
Carvery stuff.
Yeah.
Even the words carvery.
Oh, Jesus.
And the like, old mill in Tala, where I'm from. That's because I'm from Tala. Yeah. So like, I remember we'd go for a carvery and it was all a bit bamboozled by it all, but other people would want to go, so I'd go with them.
Yeah.
And I'm a chef. I'm kind, you know. Like I'll be able to be around kitchens and food that I think maybe isn't great, but other people are eating it and delighted. Like, who am I to like flip the table and go, I'm too good for this stuff?
Where is the providence?
But I'm like, why is there so much grizzle in this? Why is the gravy that color? You know, and the mash, it's just
ice cream scoops.
Like solid, like actual boiled potatoes that have been reformed. There's no love, no butter, no nothing. No. I think there's oil in it. So actually, now you say that.
Yeah. English roasts are a thing of beauty. I mean, the crackling on the pork and and a really rich gravy and huge head-sized Yorkshire puddings.
And not overcooked beef. Pink
beef. Mm. I have yet to find it in Ireland anywhere.
Jesus Christ.
No.
That is new.
Let's bear in mind that we don't go seeking it because we make a damn good roast at home ourselves.
Yeah, and that's a big thing actually for me. Yeah. I do eat a lot of Sunday roasts over here, but man, roast chicken at home, a few friends around, or even just the fella. Yeah. I'm like, that is my Sunday made.
Yeah, absolutely.
Love it.
Yeah.
100%, yeah.
Oh,
maybe that's what I'll do. I'll open a restaurant in Ireland that just opens on Sundays.
Please do.
I'm going to fix it.
Yeah.
I've come over here to fix this issue.
Yeah, I'm like, yeah, funny, I didn't do very well. They all reacted really negatively to the English-Irish girl coming over to fix Irish roasts.
It was all very pink.
That's such an Irish thing. Oh no! Well done.
Talking to me when I was eating on the plate.
It's like, yeah, but just try it, please. Yeah. Just try it, pink, and then
It is a slowly catchy monkey though to get people to move from, because you know what they miss? The hardcore caramelized deliciousness. You know, on the outside of a good beef that's caramelized and it just turns into umami or whatever that flavor is, because it's got that salt and heroin mixed on top, and it's beautiful. But if you can do a rare beef with that as on it, it's an easiest way to kind of lure them. And that's where like an anglet or a bavette is such a champion piece of meat, because it's able to take that kind of hard caramelization, and whatever it is about where it is on the beef, it just seems to have that real beefy flavor. And that's what they need to move them on to.
So it's kind of like, you know, get a whole roast and just cut off the end and go, okay, try that.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Try that next bit, and it just gets gradually pinker as it goes along. See, you find the tolerance.
Education.
It is. I like the school. I should go to the school where you just feed people slices of beef for 4 hours until they find it.
I want to go to that school. Can I be a student?
We're opening it tomorrow.
Eating out in London. We were over here for a few years, and I think that the Irish or our international audience always thought it quite exotic, because there's so many places over here. So could you spotlight a few?
Oh my God, so hard. I mean, what Robin Gill and Sarah Gill are doing in the dairy, I mean, it's a no-brainer. I'm sure you ask this question to anybody, any chef in London, they're going to mention the dairy. And the reason being, it's not just that it's an amazing restaurant with delicious food, and it's quite imaginative and creative, but also they do like the Bloodshot Supper Clubs. So that's where an awful lot of people from the industry would go and have a great night with great food and eat, you know, a food from a chef that they wouldn't normally kind of maybe hang around with. I don't know. It was really brilliant. Very clever, very innovative. Two of them are inspiring. Adam Byatt, I mean, Adam Byatt, the food he cooks is like the food I dream of. One of my best meals I had in my life was, and you know, we've all got those meals, so most of my memories are like nearly 3 stars, but this is Adam Byatt before he eventually re-won a Michelin star, because he's so amazing. It was a venison stew, and it was Christmas, and it was a Christmas party, and I'd convinced everybody at my job to go, and something had gone wrong on the floor, so it was like very long, we waited a long time, and my stew arrived, it was very small, there'd been obviously something had gone wrong in the kitchen, and I remember kind of going, oh, and then I tasted it and I went, don't care. If they could have come to me and said, I'm sorry, we don't have enough, you know, one person can get this, that's or three people. I ate this and I was like, all I could taste was venison and turnip or swede, as the other people call it, and had cabbage with it, and port, reduced port. And this is like 10 years ago. And I still think, oh, will I ever be able to make a dish like that? Like, it was so delicious. So I think Adam Byatt is amazing. Also, he's just a really inspiring person when you're talking to him. You're like, oh my God, how are you so clever? You know, he just knows everything about managing people and stuff. He's really brilliant. Where else? I mean, a lot of the places that I really love to eat in are fine dining, if I'm really honest. Like, so obviously I'd go to Bone Daddy's and places like that, but I love the theatre of dining out. I love the idea of going up an hour before we leave, get the hair done, stick on the makeup and the heels, potter out for my pre-dinner champagne, usually champagne, but I might have a Negroni, and then settle in for into the restaurant, like, oh, what's that canapés? Oh, delicious. And then as my evening goes on, I delight in dining out. When it's not really trendy, because people are way more, I've never been a burger person. I'll eat a burger, but afterwards I'll go, I didn't want that. I'll eat a fried chicken and go, I like a bit of fried chicken. But the truth is, I'm like, the calories that was all in there, I could have had canapés. And I could have finished with cheese. And that's me. Like, I really love the theatre and the routines and the systems that are for appreciating and the wonder of our kind of craft. So, yeah. My best meal I ever had was, it's hard. Mama Fuku, maybe? Pierre Gagné in Paris. It's hard, because if I ate Pierre Gagné now, how would I... Actually, no, I know. He nailed it. That was a bomb. It's hard. I mean, 3 stars aren't all that. I've eaten in 3 stars that are brilliant, they're amazing, but they're just machines that, you know... But Mama Fuku was pretty special. Have you been to Mama Fuku?
No.
Best steak I ever had in my life. I don't know what the cut was, if I'm really honest, but it couldn't have been anything above a rump. Slivers of it, and I had like a cherry puree and green peppercorn sauce. And it was just perfect. It was like, if they'd served that for my starter, my main, my dessert, my canapés, I'd have just eaten it over and over again. It was just incredible. And also I loved that we ate that meal drinking beers. with it, because I knew that the style of food, it was like, you know, with the spices, I'd never done that before, and we'd had a heavy night the night before, couldn't face more wine and champagne, because really I'd put it away. And it was just such a delight to be sitting there with a tall can, topping up my glass. It was just, oh, so cool and so delicious.
Oh, yes. Mm. Oh, salivating. Wow. One last thing that we'll have to chat about, because for many people will know your voice, and when they see the photo on the top of the blog post for this podcast, will know your face from the BBC show Royal Recipes.
Royal Recipes.
Which, well, I remember, I think it just, we kind of were like, the interview with Anna's getting a lot of hits on the blog. Suddenly, what's going on? Oh my God, TV show! It's on TV! Oh my God, it's amazing! And then we're just hooked to it. It's a brilliant series.
It's so brilliant. It's what it is that it's like warm and comforting. Mm. And it's the kind of thing that you could watch again. Now, I'm not just saying that because I'm in it, but my boyfriend is always surprised that when I find a show I like, I watch it again and again. Mm. It's usually comedy shows. I love funny shows. I will watch, obviously, cookery shows again. But I think Royal Recipes is like that, where you're like, you can be on in the background and you drift in and you drift out. But Michael Burke, I mean, what a legend.
I know.
Yeah.
Voice incredible. Made of velvet.
Yeah. Yes.
And I know with the first couple of series, he had auto cue for his stuff. Oh. They were like, no point giving this one auto cue. Look at those eyes. They're darting everywhere. She's so nervous. And then I think by the last or second last series, they said to him, listen, can you do it without auto cue? So he did. He just memorized everything.
Brilliant.
Years, dates, people. And then he'd be talking about me and I'm like, I don't know who Edward is. Well, Edward the what? The fifth, sixth, the what? He wore a hat. I don't. And then I tried to say to him, you know, I kept saying, you know, I'm from the south. You know, I'm from the south. So like, I don't know any of this stuff. And they're like, and they, like you, they'd laugh. And I'm like, no. Genuinely, I'm not joking. Yeah. I have no idea who Mary's sister was or what. I know a little bit. I know Henry, the one with the rosebud mouth. I heard a lot about him. Apart from that, he looked like a bit of a hottie in his time. I don't really know about the mad guy, you know, the mad king, and all. I don't know any of them. So there was loads of conversations where you can see my eyes kind of go. But they seemed to just take it in their stride. They didn't mind. But I really enjoyed doing the food. I liked the idea that a lot of the food was like really ancient. Like the Tudor biscuits are probably my favourite ones to make. It was like I learned a new type of biscuit. And I think when I'd say it to them, they were a little bit like, oh, you're learning stuff. And I'm like, yeah. I was like, I've no shame. I'm like, you're learning all the time as a chef. And I really enjoyed it. But he was such a professional. Like, to watch him, it's like, I mean, he is a legend.
Yeah.
But he was so brilliant. And the team, oh my God, real family team. Mm. Like, people say stuff like that, but they were so nice.
Great.
Everybody was brilliant and very lucky.
Yeah.
They saw me inside of the kitchen. That's what I was like, whoa. And I think I got a message on Twitter or Instagram, like so random when people message you. And then I was like, yeah, I was like, totally, I'll come in for an interview. Hyperventilating, like, what are they going to ask me? It was just so cool. I loved doing it. Spun Gold, or I think, are the people who make it.
It's a great series. Yeah. Yeah. Really enjoyable to watch. And I say, as a chef, having to learn all these new things that you never knew before. It's quite an experience.
And it's always interesting if it's niche. I think it's always an interesting watch.
But isn't it gas, the idea of like a Republican doing like Royal Recipes? Like, it's a bit gas. You know, how the tables have turned. It's like, let me teach you lot how to cook your food.
And it kind of isn't acknowledged. It's like, oh, here's Anna.
What a weird Irish accent from Dublin.
It's an elephant in the room. What could it be?
But yeah, and I think that's quite nice. So, you know, I'm all about the idea of living in the moment.
And it's in
the
spirit of the Good Friday Agreement as well. So that's quite nice too, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for talking to me.
Thank you.
And Myrtle.
She's asleep.
Oh. Hi, Myrtle. Do you want to be on the podcast?
Myrtle opens in May 2019. And after enjoying Anna's food many, many times over the years, we can guarantee you're in for a treat. If you can't make it over to London, Anna will also be part of the lineup at the 2019 Guinness Meatopia event, taking place at the Open Gate Brewery from the 5th to the 7th of July. You can be sure of an array of delicious Irish dishes cooked over open fire by this truly wonderful chef at that, so get a ticket quick.
Now, before you go, a quick mention about Buy Me a Coffee. Before you go, before we go. Okay, before we go, a quick mention about Buy Me a Coffee. If you've enjoyed listening to Chew the Fat over the past few seasons, and we really do hope you have, and would like to lend your support to the creation of this 100% free and independently produced podcast, you can simply buy us a coffee as a donation to the cost of keeping this production absolutely free. You can find out more details at buymeacoffee.com/chewthefat. For more episodes of Chew the Fat, for recipes, food features, and travel guides, please check out our website, gastrogaze.com.